Wonderful. Welcome to the Board of County Commissioners meeting for Wednesday, July 12th. Will you please join us for the Pledge of Allegiance?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And speaking of duties, Commissioner DeBone has grand jury duty the month of July, and so he will not be able to join us this morning. First item on the agenda is citizen input. Would anyone like to approach the board on any item that is not on the agenda? Okay, next item, we will go on to the consent agenda, and I understand that there are some items that we'd like to pull forward. Items 2, 3, and 5, as well as removing 8 and 9 for another day. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, great. So with that, I would welcome a motion with those revisions, and then we'll take the other items.
I would move to the motion to approve the consent agenda.
As amended.
Yeah. Move to approve the consent agenda as amended.
Okay, I'll second. Further discussion? Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And chair votes yes. So now let's take item 2, which is consideration of board signature of document number 2017-341, an intergovernmental agreement between public health and the Oregon Health Authority. So please join us. And I do want to say one other item on the consent agenda is a contract for personal services contract for psychiatry, which in Deschutes County and actually nationally has been a challenge to secure those services. So I just wanted to give a shout out to the team for making that happen. And so I'll turn it over to both of you. Please introduce yourself for the record, and then I believe that we have just a few questions on the contract with OHA.
Good morning. I'm Pamela Ferguson. I'm one of the public health program managers for Deschutes County Health Services.
Excellent.
Hi, and I'm Tom Kuhn, community health manager at Health Services.
Great. Okay. So this is the first IGA that we've had come before Commissioner Henderson. Yes, and it is pretty, yes, exactly. Not necessarily standard, but fairly so. And so please, if there are questions, go right ahead.
Yeah, if you want, maybe I'll just ask the questions, because I didn't read it word for word, but I did go through it. And I, one of the reasons I wanted to put it on the action agenda is I kind of had wanted to get some background on it and understand it, because I assume we'll see these annually. And so I was kind of getting some scope of it and that sort of thing. So I guess the first question I have is, historically, have we done these for how many years have we done these kinds of contracts, if you're aware?
I've been with the county for 7 years, and we've definitely done it that whole time, but we've been doing it prior to that. I don't know the exact year when it started.
Is this a contract that they prepare and send to you, or...
Yes, it is. They send to us. We have legal review. We review it to see if the funding amounts look appropriate, and it goes through the process like other contracts.
Do you? Is there feedback? I mean, is it like a mortgage loan contract where you don't have any say? I mean, I guess I'm asking council too whether we're involved in any. Is there anything discussed or negotiated in it?
Well, one of the things is it contains all the program elements, which have descriptions. And those staff throughout the year have opportunities to give input towards what the work is and also the funding amounts. So by the time it gets to this final form, it's been reviewed by pretty much everyone and is ready to go. So it's not too often that we have any changes.
And I saw, so speaking of that, it looks like the body of the work, so this is state funding. Is this really federal money that comes to the state and then is passed on, or is this really state taxpayer-generated money?
It's a little bit of a combination of both, and in the very back of it, the last 6 pages, they show where the funding stream comes from.
Okay, that's, those last few.
But, yes, there's a large amount of federal funding that comes through.
So the Oregon, oh, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to give you an example. Program element 40, which is our WIC program, and again, in those last few pages, federal award agency is the Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutrition Service, and the total federal award, so this is federal funding that comes through the state to us here in Deschutes County.
Which page is that you're looking at?
We are on page 146. And then the amount awarded to Deschutes County is $600,000.
And it helps to offset the cost of the programs that we are mandated to provide, as well as programs in which we also help to supplement with general fund throughout the year as well. Okay. So
yes.
But this is a nice summary because it calls out if it's state or federal funding.
So those back pages would be, I'm kind of looking at it as from a reference for if I wanted to look things up or whatever, so I see where you're talking about. So just looking through that, you can see kind of which is federal and which is state and that sort of thing. Regarding the budget, are these the total? I see, you know, you have there's a section that has a bunch of elements, you know, does list the elements, and I see that it funds specific things, vaccinations of certain kinds, STD prevention, HIV, you know, and I kind of see the scope of it. Is that all the money that the county spends for those programs, or is this just the, and does it include personnel, or is it just?
Yes, it does include personnel, but of course we can't implement these programs at the full level we'd like to without county general fund support. Some of the programs are a little better funded than others. For example, our immunization program, they fund us about $44,000, and that doesn't even quite cover the cost of our part-time immunization coordinator.
And add some of the documents handed out in the budget committee, the binder from Health Services breaks down the program areas and how much is general fund.
Yes.
So this is strictly the contract with the Oregon Health Authority, that piece of our budget that was part of the budget implementation that we just went through as well.
Yes. And this is $1.9 million worth of program funding.
And do you know, so that's about, you know, 1/20th of our overall funding, I think, for the department, roughly, or something like that. So when they set these budgets, they come up with $44,000 for that program, and there's $100,000 for this. Is there any, I mean, rhyme or reason to how they get to those numbers from a state perspective?
Well, we, for example, I am the co-chair of the State Preparedness Committee, and so the members of that committee work with the state to determine a funding formula to go to the locals, and it's population-based, but also they have base amounts as well. So there is time and input towards how that amount's generated. You know, we're always trying to push for more funding, but sometimes there's only so much that they have available, so that's how we come up with the dollar amounts.
Do we start in any one of these, do we start with, like, say the WIC program, does it fund all of WIC, or does the county also?
The county provides a generous amount of general funds for the WIC program. And that amount that we get, which is about $600,000, is based on the number of clients that we serve, and there's a formula. I want to say it's just over $100 per client. So during the course of the year, we may see an amendment where they give us a little bit more money because we're seeing more clients, or they may take a little money away and give it to another county that is seeing more clients.
And those typically show up on the consent agenda because it's really service delivery programmatic funding and ends up, we wouldn't say no to the funds. We've already, the service.
Well, I'm not suggesting we say no to anything. I'm just trying to create how we get to the budgets and how they get to their budgets. And, you know, because we hear so much about the change in the healthcare funding streams and what's coming up. And
well, I think you're raising great questions. The state of Oregon went through in 2013 a very aggressive look at public health in the state of Oregon and came up with the modernization of public health in the state of Oregon. And I think it was quite clear that we are sorely lacking in terms of the mandated services, the necessary services, and then the financial contribution from the state of Oregon in terms from a county's perspective to be able to provide those services. There's a disconnect there. So there was a small amount of funding that was in this most recent budget through the state, but I would say very small, to help get the state to a higher level of being able to provide the necessary funding to meet the needs within counties to provide the service.
Mm-hmm. So this funding is this part of the new biennium for the state, or does it kind of cross over?
I mean, so that's why we're getting it now, because my understanding is this was through the session. So if you want to.
Yes, this is the funding, which, of course, the dollar amounts in here are just for one fiscal year. but the contract is for two fiscal years. So any of the funding amounts you see will be approximately 50% of what the full amount for the biennium is. And the modernization funds, it was approximately $5 million for the biennium, but then the state keeps 20% of that, which would bring it down to $4 million, which then, if you divide it by year, brings it down to $2 million to divide amongst all the jurisdictions. So
the modernization component for the entire state of Oregon is $2 million?
Yeah, for the locals.
And the identified amount of money, was, I can't remember. I think there was $30 million in the budget, and that was still viewed as really as a pittance. It's we are, I believe, 47th in the United States in terms of public health funding to provide the services that are necessary to protect our communities.
Mm-hmm. And what's overall the difference between the $5 million and the $30
million? Budget discussions at the state level.
Yeah. Started at $30
million.
The governor's recommended budget was 30. I think that the committee, the task force on the modernization of public health, was around 60 for this year. I'm maybe a little fuzzy. It could have even been around 90. Yeah. Anyway, it was 30, shaved down to 5, which happens to then end up being about 2.
But that's just the modernization component of targeted money or something?
Well, it does help to bring some of the programmatic dollars up a bit to meet the need of, because we were mandated to provide a service, and they want continuity of service alignment across the state to where no matter where you go, you can expect to have these foundational capabilities. But then the challenge is, how do you fund that? And so it's quite a...
And so if it's $2 million left for the state for a year, and then so of this $2 million, how much is it, $50,000 or something? Or
I don't know.
I think there's about 35 jurisdictions, and you know they'll probably, I believe the funding is going to be competitive, but also probably population-based to some degree. So we're not really sure how much extra funding we might get, but I imagine it's not going to be... not significant.
That means we bid against, or we go after it against other counties or other mm-hmm. jurisdictions?
Well, we're hoping maybe we can do it as a tri-county application. That'll make our application much stronger.
So for that little part of money that hasn't been really allocated in this budget or this agreement, mm-hmm. it's something that'll be coming this year that you work on to get additional funding?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. With the different, you know, the elements part looks like it's basically kind of different programs or whatever. Is there a tie? You know, I did a tour of the facility, so I kind of, I went through mm-hmm. the WIC area and I didn't go through the vaccination area, but I've been through the schools. I've seen what school, medical. Are each of the elements kind of different departments within the health, within your organization? Or, I mean, do you organize around their principles, or do you organize around certain principles and then you fund from their different, I mean, they put their system in of what the elements are, and or do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think historically this might have helped drive the programming, yeah. But then we also look at community needs, and if we are not funded as well from these areas, then we look for other grant sources mm-hmm. to fund other program needs that we have.
Okay. LPHA, is that Local Public Health Authority?
Correct.
I didn't find it.
Yeah.
the acronym in every document, I couldn't find it. So
that's the commissioner's local public health authority.
Okay. I think that's, let's see. And this is just cut my head back on page 104 and 105. There was something called the Financial Assistance Award. And is this kind of a summary of the breakdowns? Is this in one spot? I didn't. Of how much funding comes in to different.
Yes. Yeah. And generally, when amendments come through, I just go straight to these pages.
Yeah.
They're in every amendment, and they have little notes of why the amount might have changed or gone up or gone down.
Yeah.
So it's pretty clear, and we get amendments almost monthly. So it's a very.
What does that mean? Get amendments?
Well, some funding streams go up. I mean, these amounts that you see before you today will be changed, will be different within the next couple months. Not significantly, but sometimes they find a little more money, or they find some supplemental grant funding, or sometimes they say actually it turns out we don't quite have that much. So sometimes it's even reduced.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's very fluid. Very fluid.
So this is the agreement, but they have the right to amend the dollar amount based on their availability of funds. And
correct.
Interesting.
And we used to have all of those on the, it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, we used to have those on the main agenda. And then we finally put them on the consent agenda because it really is so standard that it just made sense to do.
Also, I think that some of the changes are signed, or the director is authorized to sign some
very
of the small changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're generally very small changes.
Well, yeah, I'm curious that they can just you set your plan in place and you start operating something and then
they take money.
This funding gets taken away. But I get, I mean, if they sometimes come out.
Yeah, that's the challenging part with public health work. We're constantly having to adjust our budgets and FTE, and it's not because we want to, but it's oftentimes these factors force us to.
It's the golden rule, right?
Yes.
You who has the gold makes the rules.
That's just in business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so do we have other questions?
No, that's all I got. Thanks for being available.
Yeah.
Answering those.
So I would welcome a motion if you feel ready.
Yeah, I'd move. Let's see, where's the. I don't know if I have the.
Here you are. Number two.
I guess I'd move approval for board signature, or I'd move board signature of document 2017-341.
Okay, I'll second. Further discussion? Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next item is item 3, consideration of board signature of document number 2017-441, the intergovernmental agreement with the Oregon Youth Authority. Ms. Stevie, hi.
Good morning, D.V. Holcomb from Community Justice.
Okay, questions on this contract?
So, I was just interested in having you kind of walk through what it was and any comments you might have about it, or, you know, how it's different than last year. If it's, I assume this is, again, like we just talked about something we do annually, or...
Okay, so it's actually a biennial. IGA, mm-hmm. and ours does not tend to vacillate as much as I just heard the public health one at all. Uh-huh. It can from time to time. Usually they'll take an amendment at the last quarter of the second biennium because they've known that cuts are coming kind of before that, and we might sort of see a shrinkage in year two. And we just sort of adjust there. So this is an IGA with the Oregon Youth Authority for two streams of funding that come through the same IGA. One is called BASIC. And it's really Oregon state money that is used to supplement what is considered basic county juvenile jurisdiction obligations. It's a pretty small amount of money given our actual obligations. It's just a sort of a little a tip, like
a tip.
It's a tip for what we do primarily on our own through the county. This year, that's around the biennium. Is around 440. And this biennium, so we get this money every biennium. We have gotten it, I think, I've been with the county almost 17 years, I think, and it was around when I arrived. It does fluctuate from time to time, mostly on, you know, state budget outlook. It's a formula grant. It's really based on the percentage, our percentage of the youth population, 10 to 17. And then there is some...
In the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Correct. So this biennium, we did get a little bit more than last biennium, but really kind of basic current service level. Our juvenile population increased by about 1,000 since the last time they looked at it, but not too much. That's not really where our population growth comes from in the county.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than we had budgeted for because at the time the governor's recommended budget on this was much lower than they actually ended up with, which was kind of nice. So the basic is 440. The other stream is about 370 for the biennium, and that's called diversion. And that's it's also to support what we do in the county, but it's really aimed at the highest risk youth who may be at risk of heading to an OIA placement, a state custody situation.
Mm-hmm.
So we have basic, we have diversion. Our county, our department, kind of utilizes an evidence-based practice model to use both streams of funding, and primarily it funds our functional family therapy program. It funds all of it except for the small bit of that FFT program that we use to serve kids who aren't yet in the juvenile justice system. We wouldn't be allowed to use this money for that.
That program is the one where you get involved in families dealing with or kids having problems or whatever, and they try to do a kind of almost an intervention or a
correct
at home. Yeah, okay. So that's what that's the mm-hmm. functional family therapy
yeah.
program. And that's the diversion program goes primarily to that.
We kind of do both.
Oh, both.
Okay. Right. We do both. We have some medium risk offenders who aren't really at risk of going to the OIA, but we still think we could stop their offending cycle with FFT, but then we have some that get very close, much more high risk, and they also get FFT. That FFT is kind of agile. It allows to work with both types. The other bit of funding we use, is alternatives to OIA placement, basically. And with that, we have two. We have very limited resources in the county for out-of-home placements that aren't state-funded for our population. They tend to be boisterous, offending. Many have assaults or behaviors that just are hard for foster homes or other kinds of placements. So we use this money for two things. One is a really great program through Intercept, Youth Villages Intercept program. That's a very intensive in-home treatment. It's like a step above FFT. There's a worker who goes, are you familiar with that program? So I don't need to describe it. It's a family intervention.
At any time and
much more intensive. So that's
called again.
It's called Intercept.
Intercept, yeah.
Yeah,
and that's new to our service.
Yes, it is. Last year or two. Yes, we're very excited. We behavioral health has a big contract with Intercept, but again, that issue of the type of youth you're talking about, we have a separate contract as the juvenile department with Intercept to serve. We don't have a lot of space because it's a pretty expensive program, but we hope to serve maybe between 2 and 4 youth. So these would be the youth who are just at the cusp, like this close from being placed out of home into state custody. So it's kind of a last-ditch effort.
And is Intercept a separate entity, a nonprofit or a government agent?
It's a nonprofit. Youth Villages is, I believe, the name of the nonprofit.
Is that local or is that a statewide?
Nation.
Youth Villages is national, and it was run by Lynn Saxton,
yes.
who's actually now with the Oregon Health Authority.
Yes.
But it was based out of, I know there's a Youth Villages placement facility that's in the Merrillhurst area.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's where their offices are located. I think their offices may be more Portland proper, but yeah. out of the Portland area.
Another kind of stupid question. What's the Oregon Youth Authority?
Stupid question. The Oregon Youth Authority is a division of the state of Oregon that handles youth at the very high end of offending. So youth who are formerly in the county jurisdiction, but who have an offense that is either chronic or serious enough that they get placed into the custody of the Youth Authority. So they have essentially youth prisons, youth correctional facilities.
Is this McLaren's and Hill?
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
That's what I agree.
Okay. Yes. And also in many, many residential facilities that aren't mm-hmm. secure, but are that kind of second step between
so
a county.
The agency or the department that runs those facilities,
yes.
and then they're funding counties to do the services for people
correct.
That are not at that level, essentially.
Yeah, to try to keep our kids out of their system.
Yeah. What? Any explanation for why you got more than you thought you'd get, or what? I mean, we just heard how
they took it
other
from
things.
Public health.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm curious. I mean,
that's an interesting question. I think around all of these areas, it looks to me like correctional funding and criminal justice funding came out pretty healthy this biennium compared to some other entities all around. The OIA budget as a whole did take a hit, but these particular funds did not. Okay. And that may have been, I mean, they're pretty small change to the OIA budget generally, but we had some pretty good lobbying efforts for county funding as well.
I think it's the push of trying to serve in community versus the utilization at the state system, which is so costly.
Yes.
Not to mention doesn't bear the same benefit to the individual, but there was a big push probably the last two biennium in terms of legislatively the utilization piece, is justice reinvestment and thinking differently about how services are delivered. It hasn't always been, really it was more begging before, and now it seems like there is a light that's shining on the fact of you get better outcomes if you're serving within community than if you're utilizing the state system.
Yeah,
I believe the Youth Authority itself has, its budget cycle this year ended up with closing of yet another correctional facility. So they've closed one, they're closing a second one, and of course they've consolidated the whole McLaren-Hillcrest deal into one. So they themselves are moving towards more of looking at residential placements that aren't quite those hard beds that take so much more staffing and intensive supervision. Mm. And that's based, I think, on costs, but also on the outcomes. And their forecast is that they need many more non-secure placements than secure placements.
Since this does go a lot to functional family therapy, how many youth does that, do you, I don't know the word, serve or are you involved with per year?
We probably have about 120 referrals per year. And of those, we're able to see, or, you know, what turns out to be an eligible referral is right around 90, 95. So we have about 75 families completing every year.
Okay, I don't have any other questions, unless there's anything else you want to explain to me or appreciate your time.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, so if we have no further questions, I welcome a motion on item 3. There you go.
Yeah, I got it here. I'll move approval of board signature of document 2017-441. Is that what this is?
Yes, it is. Okay, and I'll second for the discussion. Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. Thank you very much, Stevie. And we will move on to item 5, board consideration of financial policies. And there are 4 of them. Mr. Lowry, nice to see you. And the floor is yours. So we could take them individually, I think would be helpful. So we have, I think, is it travel that's first? Miscellaneous expenses?
Well, please. I guess I would ask the question, are there specific questions on any individual policies that I can answer?
Actually, what I'm interested in doing is I'm willing to approve. I think I asked, thanks for your time yesterday. I went through these with Mr. Lowry, and I'm willing to approve the, what's the first one, is the reimbursement policy for miscellaneous expenses. I think I got all the answers.
So let's go ahead and take that one if we can get it out of the way.
Are they all individual?
So it'd be policy, finance policy, F1.
Okay. So I'm move approval of Deschutes County Finance Policy F1 as proposed.
Okay, and I'll second for the discussion. Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. So then the next policy is, in my packet is purchasing cards.
So this is the policy that I still have some questions at, and I'd like to have a meeting where, particularly with regard to the issuance policy, and since our administrator is not here today, I'd like to have a further discussion of that.
Excellent.
With him and Wayne at the same time.
Excellent. So let's go ahead and pull that one. And that would take us to F6, which is the capital outlay.
Yeah. As I understand, I've seen the previous policy, so I don't have any problems with that. I'd move approval of Deschutes County Administrative Policy Number F6 as proposed.
Okay. And I'll second. Further discussion? Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. So then we have Policy for Payments to Suppliers, which is F15.
I guess I only had one question I wanted to verify. I guess I've seen that in the ordinances and stuff, as I understand it, the allocations of authority or of dollar amounts, et cetera, their only change that was made from current policy in terms of the $25,000, the $50,000, the $150,000, was the delegation of $10,000 to managers. That's the only thing new,
right,
in terms of the amount of, and that's in this.
Right.
Okay. So with that understanding, I'd move approval of Deschutes County Finance Policy Number F15 as proposed.
Okay. I'll second. Further discussion? Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. Thank you, Wayne. So it sounds as though we will bring back that other when you feel, and if there are pieces that you'd like to share with the full board, we can obviously get it on a work session as well.
Yeah, so when Tom gets back, I'll talk to him about it. We'll set up a meeting and get those issues talked through, and then we'll start the process again.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank you. Okay. Next item is item 13. And that is consideration of board signature of resolution number 2017-038, imposing public use fire restrictions on unprotected wildlands within unincorporated Deschutes County and all lands owned by Deschutes County. Hi.
Good morning. Ed Keith, Deschutes County Forester. These fire regulations are something that the board has been putting in effect each summer since 2014, which was following the Two Bulls fire. Human-caused fire that was burned very quickly early in the season. We were going into drought then, and we were looking at ways to prevent human-caused fires, essentially. Since then, we've basically been mirroring what the Oregon Department of Forestry does on ODF-protected lands within the county. Those restrictions have been enacted as of midnight June 30th. And these proposed restrictions are essentially verbatim a standard set of essentially what I would consider best practices for preventing human-caused fires. These are proposed to go into effect for county-owned lands as well as those lands that don't have any fire response, no structural or wildland agency that responds to wildfires if one should occur within the county. You may notice if there's a concern or a particular landowner or person wants a waiver of one of these, we can consider that. I have been contacted from a couple individuals in the past. For example, there's a provision for blasting, and they were doing some rock pit development in the east part of the county on private land, and we came up with some equipment that needed to be on site, water, fire extinguishers, tools, those sorts of things, and then they proceeded with their project. So these are not hard and fast. You cannot do these, but I would usually work with a landowner if I was contacted to try to mitigate anything that might cause a fire. They are set to expire by default on October 15th, which is typically when the weather changes for the year. I can come back to you if it happens to, I think we had one year where weather really changed about October 1st, and we took those off a couple weeks earlier. So they can be repealed earlier, but by default would be removed by October 15th. I would just mention that we do have a press release, so we would plan to get that out to the public through a press release if you choose to pass these today, along with an online map so that those lands are actually defined on a map. People can look up their address or scroll around the map and look at that, as well as being able to, say, come into my office if they don't have that capability and see what lands are impacted by this.
Excellent. Do we do any coordinated outreach in terms of public, social media, those sorts of things with ODF or any of our other partner agencies?
Yes, particularly with Department of Forestry, since these regulations for private lands are kind of standard. But as fire restrictions may go into effect for public land as well, the press release actually lists where you can go if you're if these restrictions don't apply to you, but you're interested in other parts of the county. So for ODF, there's a website that we list in the press release, so people don't have to go searching around, as well as the website for the federal public lands. Should somebody have questions about those?
Great. Other questions?
I was trying to find my copy, which is on this pile of paper here, so I had to borrow Eric's. I remember I had written down a couple things. This is not just county lands. How broad is? I mean, what would the map show?
I actually have that up to kind of give you a thumbnail sketch.
Oh,
read your mind.
Look at that. That's pretty smart.
Most of these lands are within the eastern part of the county. Again, on private lands where there is no fire protection. So so that's the red lands are unprotected lands, and then the yellow lands, if I zoom in just to kind of see, are identified by the yellow lands are county-owned lands. So there's...
And what makes them unprotected?
There is no... there's no fire district. There's no taxing fire district. Or an Oregon Department of Forestry also does not provide protection to those lands. So it's outside of all the 8 structural districts, or now we have 9, sorry, with alfalfa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's outside of all those, as well as the lands that are outside of those that are not protected by the Oregon Department of Forestry. So.
And then I assume that all the white is BLM protected land?
In the east part of the county, the parts that aren't shaded in are mostly BLM lands. And then as you go to move a little bit more to the west, would be getting into Forest Service lands. So, yeah, so all the protection agencies for the wildland would be the Department of Forestry for private lands. They protect private lands through a fee. The Forest Service and BLM provide fire protection for federal lands.
Mm-hmm.
And then the structural departments provide protection in, you know, for like Redmond Fire Department, Bend Fire Department, Blackbeard Ranch, Sun River, Lapine, Alfalfa. And then these are lands that there is no such agency that responds to a fire.
They're either state lands or they're private lands without a fire district. So
correct.
Okay.
So it's essentially, if a fire were to start out there, it may be a landowner with their own tender or a pump that they would stick in an irrigation ditch or something like that, or run their own dozer if it would happen on private lands. If those lands happen to start to threaten BLM lands, then BLM would start to respond to those, but that's not always the case that threat exists. And so there's really no, you know, organized district.
So this goes through October?
October 15th.
So this
currently.
So this would impact things like deer hunting on private lands. You can't use an ATV or you can't theoretically, right? Isn't
correct.
That, that's what it's saying. I mean, except on improved roads, which improved road is what, a gravel road or
something with surfacing on it, correct?
Not just going out through the countryside, okay. And so you really do you ever have enforcement problems with this?
We haven't in the 3 years that we've done it had anything that we've actually gotten to the level of enforcement. I have had people call and ask, can I have a fire or can I do this activity, or somebody wants to come to my property and do this activity, and so I can have something to refer them to that says what they are not supposed to do during this time period.
Yeah. Important to us when we first had this consideration before the board was the piece of the variance that for a private property owner to be hard and fast, as Ed stated, that variance process is something that's not used often but gives the opportunity for some flexibility within this. But it's really kind of coalescing common sense on paper. That's how I've viewed it.
These are just things that you probably, when we have such, you know, high chances and probability of wildfire, probably certain things that you shouldn't do.
Yeah. I'm just kind of interested in the overlap between our control of private lands and mm-hmm. then, you know, it abuts right up to federal lands or whatever. And that's something I'm just learning about in the different fire committees I'm in, that there's the jurisdiction stops here and the fires go where they want, but the
yeah.
jurisdiction stops. And then
there's definitely a patchwork of fire protection across the state of Oregon, and particularly in the eastern part of the state, these lands that don't have a, you know, an organized fire response are a concern. We still have, you know, the law enforcement response and the evacuation responsibility of notifying residents and trying to make sure they're safely out of the way of a wildfire, but there's no agency that's necessarily going to come, and for that reason, then there's no, say, like mutual aid or anything else that you could ask for either. So,
yeah. So did you develop these? I didn't hear. Maybe you said
the exhibit one is actually almost verbatim from what the Department of Forestry uses for private lands on the west part where they protect forest lands. So. So like this, the Bull Springs Tree Farm, for example, has these in effect right now. Basically, Sisters west of Bend down to Lapine, these have been in effect since midnight June 30th for ODF protected lands. And we've tried to kind of ease the confusion of, you know, different regulations on different lands have mirrored those for these lands.
Okay. Well, I haven't had any feedback on it one way or another. I'm just kind of curious about the, you know, the scope and the origin. And there, it seems like with private owners, there are things that would go on. I mean, if starting with the first one, smoking, I mean, if they drive around in their ranch and they're off the road, they could be smoking. People could be mowing grass other than commercial culture or harvest of agricultural crops. I mean, there's things that, like I said, hunting is another one that, but anyway, I guess we haven't any problems so far.
We haven't. I would say, you know, we're not deploying the full force of the county sheriff to try to spy on what people are doing. We're trying to provide people with the best practices to do. And then also, you know, if somebody would want to hunt and called me up, we could come up with, okay, well, you need to do these things if you're going to drive off-road, for example, or like the example I gave was for rock blasting, but it could be for any number of practices. In the past, we haven't had a lot of those, but it's not a cumbersome process, something that if I'm in the office, I could turn around within a day and say, you know, here's what you should have on site so that if a fire would happen, since nobody's going to respond, you could effectively put the fire out. So.
Well, most people probably wouldn't know that these are. Did you say you do send these out to property owners that are in the red? Or
we provided a public news release,
the paper and
right.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
So it's typically been picked up by, you know, radio stations or the bulletin and published there. So.
Huh.
Okay. Further questions?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Let's see. I'd move board signature of resolution number 2017-038.
Okay. And I'll second for the discussion. Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. Thank you very much. Okay. Next item on the agenda is consideration of chair signature of document number 2017-471, notice of intent to award contract for Cell 7 Engineering Services. Mr. Shimke?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tim Shimke, Director of the Department of Solid Waste. The department is solicited for engineering services for the upcoming construction of Cell 7 at Knott Landfill. Those services include geotechnical investigation of the excavation, seismic analysis as required by the state of Oregon, design of the liner system, leachate collection system, landfill gas systems, getting approval from DEQ for those designs. Developing plans, specifications, contract documents, assistance during the bidding process for a contractor, and construction oversight services after the contractor is in place. We had 5 responses to the RFP. The selection team unanimously chose Jerry Friesen and Associates as the most qualified proposer. They gave a very detailed, complete proposal. We negotiated a price with them of about $269,000. That price is less than 10% of the expected construction costs, and that's usually a yardstick that we use. Something between 10 and 15% seems reasonable. We're recommending approval of this letter of intent to award contract to G. Friesen and Associates.
Would you mind going through who is on your selection committee?
Myself, my operations manager, Chris Doty, as well as my landfill engineering tech.
Okay.
4 people.
Okay.
One outside the department.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Questions?
Well, I met with Mr. Shimke yesterday, and I guess, I don't know if it's a question, it's kind of a decision on my part. I was troubled by the fact that we've been provided with the actual bids, and there was 100% difference between the top and the bottom. And we use a scoring method to decide the who's chosen. But be that as may, I guess I'd like to see some reconciliation of why the differences, and I guess I'd be in favor of a little more work before this contract's awarded. He provided me some good understanding, I think, of, and has provided a good spreadsheet as to the different categories of what's different. This company has apparently been awarded 5 of the 6 previous. They know what they're getting into. They know what it is. They did a better job, as I understand, of presenting. But I think that's kind of natural because they know the territory. I think when there's a possible savings of $50,000 or $100,000, that it ought to be looked at a little like a second step going back to the originals and finding out about. I mean, there's some inadequacies, I guess, in their presentation, et cetera. But just having been involved some with engineers and architects and then also been involved with bidding before, I think we're in a position where we can negotiate some with people because we're apparently under this contract not tied to a a low bid type thing like a public works. He has some flexibility there, and I'd like to see if we can either get the contract from Friesen down some, because they should have, to me, economies of experience that they would they would know what they're doing. One of the things that we talked about yesterday was the number of design pages they come up with, and in house building, I don't know if it's at all the same, but some of those design pages that are provided in house building are forms. They get them so they know what they're doing, and they look like just this last set of plans. So I don't know if they're necessarily creative work or take more effort or whatever. I guess that's what I'd like to be looking at is, can that come down, or is there, the second highest score was the least expensive. So there is a big gap in the scoring, but, I don't know what's the most important thing in this, but to just say, well, because they're the best score, they're worth 100% more than the one mm-hmm. next. It just seems to me that I'd like to see a further work on it. And you're in a good position to either negotiate freeze and some saying, hey, this is, and as I understand it from council, that we have some flexibility in terms of how we approach these kinds of contracts in terms of negotiating. And I'd like to try that. That's what I would recommend.
The freeze number that you have in front of you, $269,000, that has been negotiated down by almost $100,000 from their original proposal. So we have kind of gone through that process and looked line by line at what they're proposing. Most of the savings were in their expected level of participation for services during construction. So we felt that that was where they were high. This is a smaller cell, almost half the acres, and there should be less effort there. So we negotiated that number down. So we've already taken that step.
But then that even makes me more concerned in a way, because if it's half the size and they're charging what they did for the last one, they're still high in my view. I mean, and so they've done enough of these that this is not, I don't know. I don't know where it goes. I just think it's when it's so many. I mean, it's not just the next one down was 100% less than there's one that's only 20,000 above the least one. And so to pick the very highest one who's the most experienced, I mean, it's kind of a luxury. It's what you do when you have all the money in the world. You just pick the most expensive builder or the most expensive whatever because you think you're going to have less risk, and that may be true. But it's a lot of money that we're spending on it, and I guess that's so. I don't know what else you. I guess that I don't know. That's where I am. I'm not going to approve it at this point until I see what. I guess I'd like to know more information about the next couple bidders. What are they missing that would get them up? I mean, you went and negotiated these down. Did you go back to the number two person and say, hey, you're missing this, this, and this. What would that add to the contract? Or did we just go to the top and negotiate down?
That's the procedure is you choose your best qualified firm. You attempt to negotiate a price with them. If you can't come to an agreement with that, then you go to the next qualified firm, and then you negotiate with them, as opposed to negotiating with all five firms at the same time. That's the way it's laid out.
By who?
By contracting law, I believe.
Yeah, that's in ORS Chapter 279C. It's also part of our county contracting code. And frankly, to proceed the way I think you're suggesting would really open us up to a protest from the successful bidder. We have a proposal, part of a bid process. We identified the criteria that were going to be evaluated. And so if this bid is not going to be awarded, this proposal off of this bid, then we're going to need to rebid it.
You're saying, because I asked you about this yesterday, what the law is and whether we have any flexibility. So you're saying the only person you can negotiate with is the one that's chosen on the criteria. You can go back to them and negotiate down, but you can't go to the two or three bidder and say, hey, you're a better bid, but you're missing some things. So it's totally on the quality. So what?
Right.
So we have no flexibility at this point.
At this point, if you're going to go back to the original pool and attempt to, I don't know if it would be negotiate or further refine the criteria, then the successful bidder is going to be prejudiced by that. He or she or that firm, submitted a proposal that was consistent with the identified criteria in the RFP. They were selected as the highest, most qualified proposal, with dollars cost not being a criteria in that evaluation. And so, yeah, to go back and try to finesse those issues with the firms that were not selected would be a
so you'd
would
have
prejudice
to,
the
you'd
selected.
Have to just reject this proposal or whatever and start a new process.
You could cancel this process, this procurement, and proceed with a new one that either does or doesn't include cost as a criteria weighted to a certain percentage, which is part of the evaluation.
So let me, you know the history of this, Tim. With the last one we did, were they the high bidder on the last one too?
I can't answer that. I don't know if they were the highest. I would not.
They got it, so they so we don't know if it's the highest. Do you remember?
I don't believe that they have been consistently the highest proposer in the past, but I haven't researched that. I did pull together their last five contracts with us. You asked the question, is since we assume that some of these things they're simply cranking out what they did last time, their number should come down. And so I've got some information about how those individual six or seven items in the bid sheet have looked over the years to try and give you an idea of how that's progressed. You know, and I think it's logical. In other words, it's a smaller number now than it was when we did sell one by a significant amount. You know, so they put a lot of it.
The whole thing is a smaller number, or just the certain
for certain elements.
Are the other ones?
Would you like to see it?
Sure, if you. Based on what we talked about yesterday, that, you know, how did that, what's the pattern? Well, thank you for doing that.
Sell one, the first one we did, and this is 22 years ago. So you see the line number 4, plans and specifications, and number 3, design. Mm-hmm. You know, 120,000, 71,000. This year, that's you know, 58,000 and 68,000, or 16,000. Mm-hmm. So I think it reflects the fact that they're recognizing that this is pretty much a repeat of what they've done in the past, and it doesn't have near the level of effort in it as it did in years 1 and 2.
Is this contract not to exceed that amount? So if we were to choose one of the other, I mean, which we, let's say that we just could go with a different bidder, are those amounts, is this 269 or in change, and not to exceed amount, or can there be change orders on top of that?
I would think that we would be very comfortable that would not result in any change orders, and there would have to be something significant that was unanticipated, you know, that might justify that.
Okay.
But simply because, gee, we thought this was going to take, you know, 20 hours of time and it took 25, we'd like to get more money, that would not be a valid reason for a change.
There were other pieces within the other proposals that were not touched on the same as they were in the original one.
Yes.
My concern would be if it were not a not to exceed amount, that those other numbers could change significantly, which I think is the wild
card. Yes, and because these are
I see the same issue that not discussed or not included. And but I guess before you award it to somebody else, that's why I didn't realize until now that we really can't ask anybody else to look at it again. So that's I learned that new this morning. I also learned that, you know, this is interesting. I also didn't realize this was already cut down. It looks like almost 100,000. On the sheet, you've got 376. And the contract is for 269.
Yes.
And so you say so the thing you negotiated down was the services during construction?
That number 5 line, that was where most of the negotiation came down.
So that's another thing I hadn't realized until this morning.
We feel, we feel that the level of effort at 269 is what we feel will get us the best construction bids and will give us the best product when we're done. Now, if we thought that Friesen was just unacceptable and he refused to negotiate, and we said, okay, we're going to go and talk to the number 2 firm, then we would go through and I shared the big spreadsheet and we would say, you did not address seismic analysis. You have to add that in, and their dollars would come up. And in most of those categories, I would say there would be increases. Now, whether when we finished that project or that process, they were still less than the 269 that Friesen has bid, I don't know if that would be the case or not.
Yeah, and I have to say, Tim, I'd be uncomfortable going back if Friesen were to just walk away. I'd be uncomfortable with the process going back to whoever number 2 is and addressing the substance of what they're going to do or not do. Typically, the process, it's a dollar issue at that point because the criteria, the selection criteria, have already been evaluated by you and your panel. And so
And there is a significant delta between the two proposals.
Yeah, and there's a real sticky point there where, you know, the last thing we want to do is set ourselves up for a protest from Friesen.
So are you saying, Dave, that if we were to reject Friesen and go to number two, that we would not be in a position to increase their fee by telling them to add more hours of effort for things that we thought that they were deficient in?
Well, it's kind of like change orders are typically limited to, depending upon jurisdictions, anywhere from 15% to 25%. If this becomes a wholesale reconstruct of their proposal, then you've really disadvantaged and prejudiced who was your selected.
And I would agree. I would think that looking at when we looked at the various, you know, level of work that each firm included, that's what this would be a total reconstruct of number two, three, or four, wherever we looked at, because they were very short in a lot of areas.
Yeah. So I guess, so what I'm hearing is that we can't really undo this unless we want to go back to the starting gates or something, which I didn't, like I said, didn't know until this morning. You've negotiated out. I guess what I would look at is if I'm in the business of doing this kind of engineering and I get a request for proposal from Deschutes County to do cell 8, which is some down the road, and I'm also getting requests for jobs in Seattle and this place, you know, Salem, and I know that those places have changed who they use from time to time. And I look at this one, I say, well, 6 out of the last 7 have been given to Friesen. This is a low priority. We're not likely to get this job, is how I would look at this. So I would not necessarily put as much unless I was out of work. So in terms of us getting the best price, I guess what I would think is, and it's not now, it would have been before today, it would have been somewhere in your process, going back to people that are giving you a good number, getting the blanks filled in, saying, and I don't know how that's in the request for production or whatever, or request for proposal or whatever, it's you missed items C and D. Like the one missed seismic, and it also missed the gas collector. Mm-hmm. Well, those are, and I don't know how that's written into the RFP, but it's like, let's make sure we got apples to apples, because that's the biggest thing in contracting and budgets, et cetera, is are you comparing this and this? And so we're really not comparing apples to apples here. We're comparing an apple and an orange and a banana. So somewhere in the early, and this is just for the next cell. It's not relevant today, maybe, but that's a thought.
What I hear you saying is you would like us to structure our engineering solicitations to look as much like a construction bid approach as possible, and that's to a certain extent we purposely do not do that. We put out a much more general approach, you know, request, and that's basically how we make the decision: is who's done their homework, who's looked to make sure that they need to address seismic and gas and stuff.
Okay, but as the buyer of services, I would look at it as I want to make sure the people that haven't done 6 of the last 7 Deschutes landfill engineering things know. I mean, maybe they didn't do the gas. I mean, I would just be trying to get them interested to see where they are, because I think you always get it has an effect on Friesen when they bid the next one too, that they know, as opposed to we're basically today in part excluding them because things that just didn't get answered. And I don't know, I've done a lot of bidding, and what I would do is I would say, well, you know, you got the footing and the wall, but you didn't get these hold downs, or you're missing this, or so you are looking at apples to apples. You're missing, maybe they know they're missing this and maybe they don't. But the point is we basically have taken people out of contention because of things they've missed, saying it's up to you to figure it out. I just want to make sure we're helping them figure it out. So I think it gives more competition. That's just my It doesn't affect this one.
I might add, in the public contracting, it's certainly different than in the private sector, and there has to be this level of fairness and fair play, and so we can't go back and re-engineer proposals that people put in and may have dropped the ball because there's procedural rights that and process rights that other bidders that maybe did it correctly or more completely and certain rights they have. And so
I get that.
That's why I mean, if the board's inclined to say this just isn't sufficient, then I would strongly recommend that it be a new RFP that goes out, maybe with some identified criteria, maybe a mandatory pre-bid or pre-proposal submission meeting on site, and things of that nature. Well, there was one, but I don't think more than one or two folks showed up. Maybe you make it mandatory.
I'm not now going to vote against this. I'm going to vote for this today. I'm talking about the next one. Yeah, and that's what I'm talking about, is that becomes a mandatory thing. So we've got apples to apples. So they've seen, you know, and you can say, well, they were lazy. They didn't come over here. They didn't seem interested. They might get more interested if they, we're buying services, so it's good to have people interested. It's not good to have one party that, you know, gets the contract every year, because I've been in the private sector. I know what you go after and what you don't go after. And if you think somebody else has a lock on a contract, you don't go after it very often, unless you're out of work or you got some energetic person. So, yeah, I let things like that. The meeting's mandatory. Or the checklist is mandatory. You know, they have to deal with seismic. Because you know what you're after. You've done this. You know what you want them to hit. And so I'm just saying, let's have them hit that. And do is that, that's just for the next one. But
can we? Oh, sorry.
Is that?
Yeah. No, I'm supporting. Yeah, and can we also for future contracts? Can we award a certain percentage points for cost? We could certainly add that. Is that correct? Not to this. I'm talking about considerations.
Yes, and I'll be in front of you in a few weeks with award of a contract for the solid waste management plan. That's another professional type thing, and price is one of the selection criteria.
Okay.
You know, but we'll have a score of 0 to 25 for qualifications and past experience and various things. Price will be like from 1 to 10 points. So we de-emphasize the price typically when we do these.
What's that one for, Zen?
For the solid waste management plan, for deciding what to do after not landfill is full.
Mm-hmm. The consultant contract.
Yeah.
On that, okay, we can talk about that separate. Okay. The only other question I had, and I don't know, but I learned this with talking with Tim, that one of the providers that works for Friesen is somebody that has issues with the state of Oregon on contracting. So
Benny Benson is on this team, on the Friesen team.
Okay.
To handle our landfill gas, that portion of this contract.
Okay.
It's not a large portion of it, but
of the information that I have, being close to that challenge that has come up, it would not give me hesitation because it's not related to the ability to perform. It was around clarity on contracting to secure state funds. So there wasn't a inability to perform within the contract, if that's helpful.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar with the company or the owner or anything, but I just don't want to be in a position down the road where people are wondering why we awarded a contract to somebody that has just got fined
sure.
$1 million or something. You know, I don't
right.
know where it all goes. I have to learn that. I don't have any feeling myself about any of it. I just bring it up.
Yeah, I don't. They are on a path to remedy that situation, so I don't foresee an issue there. I think some may say, well, they had a challenge with the state of Oregon, but I see that so clearly defined to two separate issues. So it doesn't give me hesitation. Dave, do you
have any issue?
Yeah, I'm not totally familiar with some of what you folks are discussing, so I'm not positive. I don't want to say the wrong things, but there are, you know, standard disqualification criteria that would knock a bidder out on the front end. I don't know that what you're discussing rises to that level. you know, certainly there's
going to... Well, it's undetermined. I mean, the resolution's not resolved. This is with the state. Is it with the Department of Transportation?
It was with Connect Oregon funding. There wasn't fraudulent activity. There isn't any criminal sort of issues. It really was in some invoicing and some discrepancies in terms of the contract between the state of Oregon for Connect Oregon funding and a particular company. And so the Department of Justice was involved. They did an investigation of the contracting and of the expenditures and reimbursements and et cetera. They came back forward with a letter that was now public, essentially saying, you know, these are the things that need to be remedied. And they've been working to remedy that with the state of Oregon. So there wasn't criminal or fraudulent sort of activities. It was, you know, some there were vagaries, I will say, in the contract, the Connect Oregon contract. So what was originally determined ended up not being the final number that they need to remedy. It ended up being significantly less. But there is some reimbursement of funds, and there's also an ongoing challenge with that company to the state as to whether or not they, in fact, need to pay any funds back. I think that's and that's my non-legal, non-DOJ layman's terms of what I foresee happening right now.
And the original amount was roughly $250,000 was... the issue at issue, and you said
and I don't,
reduced.
Or? Yeah, significantly, mainly because our language, and I mean from an ODOT perspective, because we do the contracts as the OTC, that our language was not clear in terms of allowable.
So you're worried, Dave, that Energyneering, the company,
right.
Well-known expertise in landfill gas management, and that's the aspect that we are using them on. The issue with the state, they also happen to be the owner of the Sisters Airport. Good. And the issue that they're talking about is grant funds going to improve the airport that there were some questions about.
Right. How well and that piece I do have some general knowledge of, and I'm not sure that those would have any real bearing on what you're potentially putting out the bid.
Sorry, I think the only connection is that Energyneering is one of the companies that is involved on the ODOT side, just for transparency purposes. They were not providing, they are the company that is also part of the owner, as you mentioned, of the Sisters Airport. So,
so it isn't completely divorced in the sense it's not the airport. That's it is the same company that we would be using. Energy engineer.
I think it's basically the same owner of two different aspects. One company doing landfill gas work, and another company operating an airport.
Right, and as an airport tenant. So we're getting into parts that are so legalese that I feel like I'm over my skis a bit. I don't have hesitation because there is a remedy for them. And they will work that out with the state of Oregon.
It's already been.
They're working on it, and there is a legal challenge of, I believe, I haven't been briefed on it recently, but there was a challenge as they felt that they should not have to have any sort of a penalty of payback. So,
yeah, okay.
Anyway,
well, you know,
good point of bringing it.
Yeah. And there's other people with Friesen that I am familiar with that have good reputations, so it's not making a critical remark about the company. I don't. No freezing themselves. Okay. All right.
We were talking about another company that we've had other issues with in the past. That
are they in that group too?
Which company is that?
Maybe for another day.
Oh. Yeah.
So,
okay.
All right. So how would we like to proceed? We have before us. It would be chair signature of this notice of intent to award with all of the follow-up supplemental information. Do we feel like we can move forward?
Yeah, I appreciate the new information. I appreciate you showing the history because I can follow it too. I mean, that's good. I appreciate the fact that you'd already negotiated. I didn't realize that until today. And the legal explanation. So, I'm prepared unless Mr. DeBone's comments or anything. But
well, I haven't heard that there was significant concern, but I think that we have two votes to be able to move us forward today.
And I think Tim did brief Commissioner DeBone
Actually, I have not been
okay.
able to yet.
Did you?
I intend to do that, but I haven't done that yet.
Did not you provide him the additional information? Okay.
Okay. It would be good to follow up and let him know the reasons, I think, that it would abbreviate listening to us go on today. That would be a gift to him. But we do have the majority of the board, and it sounds like probably two votes to move forward. So I would welcome a motion.
Yeah, I move signature of document number 2017-471.
Okay, and I will second. Further discussion? Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. Tim, thank you very much, and Dave for walking us through that.
Thank you. And Commissioner Henderson, I appreciate your concerns, and we will adjust our approach moving forward.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay, let's move on to pay some bills. Let's convene as the governing body of the 911 County Service District. Consideration of weekly accounts payable vouchers. It's actually 2 weeks in the amount of $289,195.81.
Move approval subject to review.
Excellent. I'll second. Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. All right. Now,
memorize Tony's
well
words.
Done. Yes. Now
I miss him though. He's supposed to make these motions.
We'll now convene as the governing body of the Extension 4-H County Service District in consideration of 2 weeks of account payable in the amount of $726.95.
Move approval subject to review.
Second. Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. We will now reconvene as the Deschutes County Board of Commissioners and consider 2 weeks approval of the accounts payable vouchers in the amount of $1,731,396.40.
Move approval subject to review.
Okay. Second. And we're obviously items of note.
Yes, there are some routine bills such as $12,000 to the City of Bend for water. There's also a payment to Deschutes Transfer Company to provide transfer of solid waste and recyclables from our transfer stations to the Knott landfill. That's $95,000. In addition to some one-time projects, there's $47,000 to Seven Peaks paving for Tumalo Bridge paving, and also to Baxter Builders for some work done on the Johnson Brothers rehab. The building on the corner, it looks much better.
Oh, it looks great.
Yeah. And then actually going back to the 911 bills, there's a $250,000 payment to Communication Northwest for microwave and other equipment related to the radio project. A majority of that cost is funded by a grant from the State Interoperability Executive Committee. So that's great to hear that project's moving forward. And in fact, next Monday, all law enforcement users will migrate over to the new radio system.
Excellent. That's good news.
A lot of work being done at 911.
Wonderful. Okay. Further discussion? Commissioner Henderson?
Yes.
And Chair votes yes. Anything else to come before the board?
Nope.
I just wanted to say that last night I really enjoyed the state of the county and all the work that went into making that happen by Whitney Hale and Judith Ure and just the team. Eric, thank you for being there. And I really enjoyed Commissioner Henderson. It was our first time being out on the road show together, and I thought it went really well, and benefited a lot from your comments. And I've heard a lot of good feedback, too, about where the county is right now and kind of how we've been keeping on. And folks, I think, have a lot of confidence and trust in our ability to be good stewards. And I think being open and transparent about how we make decisions and offering a bit of levity, too, bodes well. So
yeah, I'll reiterate the thanks for to Whitney and Judith on their work on it, and Eric for helping. And it was nice to have some of the other county department heads and things out and there like that. I was surprised how many people were actually there and attending. That was good. Some of them are people that have good ties to the county and wanted to, I think, hear what we had to say, so that was interesting. So,
mm-hmm. I would add that I've been to and I've seen at least 10 of those, probably actually 15 of those, because the county does at least one a year and usually more. And I thought that overall it was one of the top performances, and it went really smoothly. I thought the commissioners did a great job.
Okay. There have been times when we don't have many people in the room, and they're focused on other. Often there's a lot of focus on the city, but I was really pleased to see the interest in the county.
Mm-hmm.
So that was
good. Well,
yeah.
Okay. Well, if there's nothing else to come before the board, we are adjourned.
Thanks.